Alberto Gonzalez, Attorney General, versus Leroy Carhart, Supreme Court of the United States, April 18, 2007. Justice Kennedy delivered the opinion of the court. These cases require us to consider the validity of the Partial Birth Abortion Ban Act of 2003, a federal statute regulating abortion procedures. In recitations preceding its operative provisions, the Act refers to the Court's opinion in Stenberg versus Carhart, which also addressed the subject of abortion procedures used in the later stages of pregnancy. Compared to the state statute at issue in Stenberg, the Act is more specific concerning the instances to which it applies, and in this respect, more precise in its coverage. We conclude the Act should be sustained against the objections lodged by the broad facial attack brought against it. In number 05380, Carhart, respondents are Leroy Carhart, William G. Fitzhugh, William H. Knorr, and Jill L. Vivekar, doctors who perform second trimester abortions. These doctors filed their complaint against the Attorney General of the United States in the United States District Court for the District of Nebraska. They challenged the constitutionality of the Act and sought a permanent injunction against its enforcement. In 2004, after a two-week trial, the District Court granted a permanent injunction that prohibited the Attorney General from enforcing the Act in all cases but those in which there was no dispute the fetus was viable. The Court of Appeals for the Eighth Circuit affirmed, we granted certiorari. In number 05-1382, Planned Parenthood, respondents are Planned Parenthood Federation of America, Inc., Planned Parenthood Golden Gate, and the City and County of San Francisco. The Planned Parenthood entity sought to enjoin enforcement of the Act in a suit filed in the United States District Court for the Northern District of California. The City and County of San Francisco intervened as a plaintiff. In 2004, the District Court held a trial spanning a period just short of 3 weeks, and it, too, enjoined the Attorney General from enforcing the Act. The Court of Appeals for the Ninth Circuit affirmed, we granted certiorari. Part 1, Section A. The Act proscribes a particular manner of ending fetal life, so it's necessary here, as it was in Stenberg, to discuss abortion procedures in some detail. Three United States District Courts heard extensive evidence describing the procedures. In addition to the two courts involved in the instant cases, the District Court for the Southern District of New York also considered the constitutionality of the Act. It found the Act unconstitutional, and the Court of Appeals for the Second Circuit affirmed. The three district courts relied on similar medical evidence. Indeed, much of the evidence submitted to the Carhart Court previously had been submitted to the other two courts. We refer to the district court's exhaustive opinions in our own discussion of abortion procedures. Abortion methods vary depending to some extent on the preferences of the physician and, of course, on the term of the pregnancy and the resulting stage of the unborn child's development. Between 85 and 90% of the approximately 1.3 million abortions performed each year in the United States take place in the first 3 months of pregnancy, which is to say in the first trimester. The most common first trimester abortion method is vacuum aspiration, otherwise known as suction curettage, in which the physician vacuums out the embryonic tissue. Early in this trimester, an alternative is to use medication such as mifepristone, commonly known as RU486, to terminate the pregnancy. The Act does not regulate these procedures. Of the remaining abortions that take place each year, most occur in the second trimester. The surgical procedure referred to as dilation and evacuation, or D&E, is the usual abortion method in this trimester. Although individual techniques for performing D&E differ, the general steps are the same. The doctor must first dilate the cervix at least to the extent needed to insert surgical instruments into the uterus and to maneuver them to evacuate the fetus. The steps taken to cause dilation differ by physician and gestational age of the fetus. A doctor often begins the dilation process by inserting osmotic dilators, such as laminaria, sticks of seaweed, into the cervix. The dilators can be used in combination with drugs, such as misoprostol, that increase dilation. The resulting amount of dilation is not uniform, and a doctor does not know in advance how an individual patient will respond. In general, the longer dilators remain in the cervix, the more it will dilate, yet the length of time doctors employ osmotic dilators varies. Some may keep dilators in the cervix for 2 days, while others use dilators for a day or less. After sufficient dilation, the surgical operation can commence. The woman is placed under general anesthesia or conscious sedation. The doctor, often guided by ultrasound, inserts grasping forceps through the woman's cervix and into the uterus to grab the fetus. The doctor grips a fetal part with the forceps and pulls it back through the cervix into the vagina, continuing to pull even after meeting resistance from the cervix. The friction causes the fetus to tear apart. For example, a leg might be ripped off the fetus as it is pulled through the cervix and out of the woman. The process of evacuating the fetus piece by piece continues until it has been completely removed. The doctor may have to make 10 to 15 passes with the forceps to evacuate the fetus in its entirety, though sometimes removal is completed with fewer passes. Once the fetus has been evacuated, the placenta and any remaining fetal material are suctioned or scraped out of the uterus. The doctor examines the different parts to ensure the entire fetal body has been removed. Some doctors, especially later in the second trimester, may kill the fetus a day or two before performing the surgical evacuation. They inject digoxin or potassium chloride into the fetus, the umbilical cord, or the amniotic fluid. Fetal demise may cause contractions and make greater dilation possible. Once dead, moreover, the fetus's body will soften and its removal will be easier. Other doctors refrain from injecting chemical agents, believing it adds risk with little or no medical benefit. The abortion procedure that was the impetus for the numerous bans on partial birth abortion, including the Act, is a variation of this standard D&E. The medical community has not reached unanimity on the appropriate name for this D&E variation. It has been referred to as intact D&E, dilation and extraction, and intact DNX. For discussion purposes, this D&E variation will be referred to as intact D&E. The main difference between the two procedures is that in intact D&E, a doctor extracts the fetus intact or largely intact with only a few passes. There are no comprehensive statistics indicating what percentage of all D&Es are performed in this manner. Intact D&E, like regular D&E, begins with dilation of the cervix. Sufficient dilation is essential for the procedure. To achieve intact extraction, some doctors may thus attempt to dilate the cervix to a greater degree. This approach has been called serial dilation. Doctors who attempt at the outset to perform intact D&E may dilate for 2 full days or use up to 25 osmotic dilators. In an intact D&E procedure, the doctor extracts the fetus in a way conducive to pulling out its entire body instead of ripping it apart. One doctor, for example, testified, "If I know I have good dilation and I reach in and the fetus starts to come out and I think I can accomplish it, the abortion with an intact delivery, then I use my forceps a little bit differently. I don't close them quite so much and I just gently draw the tissue out, attempting to have an intact delivery if possible." Rotating the fetus as it is being pulled decreases the odds of dismemberment. A doctor also may use forceps to grasp a fetal part, pull it down, and re-grasp the fetus at a higher level, sometimes using both his hand and a forceps to exert traction to retrieve the fetus intact until the head is lodged in the cervix. Intact D&E gained public notoriety when in 1992, Dr. Martin Haskell gave a presentation describing his method of performing the operation. In the usual intact D&E, the fetus's head lodges in the cervix, and dilation is insufficient to allow it to pass. Haskell explained the next step as follows. Quote, "At this point, the right-handed surgeon slides the fingers of the left hand along the back of the fetus and hooks the shoulders of the fetus with the index and ring fingers palm down. While maintaining this tension, lifting the cervix and applying traction to the shoulders with the fingers of the left hand, the surgeon takes a pair of blunt, curved, Metzenbaum scissors in the right hand. He carefully advances the tip curved down along the spine and under his middle finger until he feels it contact the base of the skull under the tip of his middle finger. The surgeon then forces the scissors into the base of the skull or into the foramen magnum. Having safely entered the skull, he spreads the scissors to enlarge the opening. The surgeon removes the scissors and introduces a suction catheter into this hole and evacuates the skull contents. With the catheter still in place, he applies traction to the fetus, removing it completely from the patient." This is an abortion doctor's clinical description. Here's another description from a nurse who witnessed the same method performed on a 26-week fetus and who testified before the Senate Judiciary Committee. "Dr. Haskell went in with forceps and grabbed the baby's legs and pulled them down into the birth canal. Then he delivered the baby's body and the arms, everything but the head. The doctor kept the head right inside the uterus. The baby's little fingers were clasping and unclasping and his little feet were kicking. And then the doctor stuck the scissors in the back of his head, and the baby's arms jerked out like a startle reaction, like a flinch, like a baby does when he thinks he's going to fall. The doctor opened up the scissors, stuck a high-powered suction tube into the opening, and sucked the baby's brains out. Now the baby went completely limp. He cut the umbilical cord and delivered the placenta. He threw the baby in a pan along with the placenta and the instruments he just used. Dr. Haskell's approach is not the only method of killing the fetus once its head lodges in the cervix, and the process has evolved since his presentation. Another doctor, for example, squeezes the skull after it has been pierced so that enough brain tissue exudes to allow the head to pass through. Still other physicians reach into the cervix with their forceps and crush the fetus's skull. Others continue to pull the fetus out of the woman until it disarticulates at the neck, in effect decapitating it. These doctors then grasp the head with forceps, crush it, and remove it. Some doctors performing an intact D&E attempt to remove the fetus without collapsing the skull. Yet one doctor would not allow delivery of a live fetus younger than 24 weeks because the objective of his procedure is to perform an abortion, not a birth. The doctor thus answered in the affirmative when asked whether he would hold the fetus's head on the internal side of the cervix in order to collapse the skull and kill the fetus before it was born. Another doctor testified that he crushes the fetus's skull not only to reduce its size, but also to ensure that the fetus is dead before it's removed. For the staff to have to deal with a fetus that has some viability to it, some movement of limbs, according to this doctor, is always a difficult situation. D&E and intact D&E are not the only second trimester abortion methods. Doctors also may abort a fetus through medical induction. The doctor medicates the woman to induce labor and contractions occur to deliver the fetus. Induction, which unlike D&E should occur in a hospital, can last as little as 6 hours but can take longer than 48. It accounts for about 5% of second trimester abortions before 20 weeks of gestation and 15% of those after 20 weeks. Doctors turn to two other methods of second trimester abortion, hysterotomy and hysterectomy, only in emergency situations because they carry an increased risk of complications. In a hysterotomy, as in cesarean section, the doctor removes the fetus by making an incision through the abdomen and uterine wall to gain access to the uterine cavity. A hysterectomy requires the removal of the entire uterus. These two procedures represent about 0.007% of second trimester abortions.